Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are here on Thursday, May 17th, 2018. The NFL Draft is over. The NFL Fantasy Summit is over. A lot of soccer stuff happening. So we're going to get to the Premier League and I guess the U.S. National Team managerial merry-go-round later on. First, I want to talk with someone who was at the Fantasy Summit, someone whose projections make up a lot of the backbone of what we do when it comes to discussing fantasy football. He has been someone who I've wanted to have on the show for a while now. You can see him all over ESPN. He's on the Fantasy Focus podcast, most frequently, I would say. It's ESPN's Mike Clay. Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. It's good to be here, making my debut on the podcast, actually. So it's good to chat with you.
Long overdue, I would say, debut on the podcast. Someone I should have had on a while ago, but my mistake. You're here now, though, and I think you have something very relevant to talk about, which are your projections when it comes to fantasy football for the 2018 season. So just to give a baseline for people, how do you put these projections together? Are you starting from just looking at each player, or are you starting from a team perspective and then working your way down?
How long do you have? We could spend a few hours on this, I think. I think the best way to look at it is a several departments, right? You almost start on one end on the league. You know, you focus on league trends. Yep. Another area would be the team and team history and schemes run by coaches and coordinators. Mm-hmm. And then the other would be on the player level, you know, trying to determine target shares and carry shares and efficiency for each player. So there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of levels. There's a lot of, departments, if you will. And they kind of all come together. When I'm done, it's essentially, you know, I attack all the areas. I hit refresh and we have some numbers. After that, we're just tweaking. It's objective and statistic here. You know, I try and develop, rate stats and look at league history for some of this, but mm-hmm. we also have to watch the news every day and keep up on which guys are trending up and which guys are trending down in terms of playing time. And, there's a lot of variables on both sides of the ball, as you know. So, long process. We could do a whole series of shows on this, I think.
All right. So that's how these projections work. And we're going to get to Odell Beckham, several other big players and their projections for the 2018 season in a moment. But we're going to talk about 2018 projections. Let's talk about security systems in 2018, because you can't just go with what you had previously. Security is important to all of us. We all want to be secure in our home, our apartment, wherever we live. But you want to have some privacy, too. And that's why SimpliSafe is so great, because it's not just your basic, simple security system. They obsess over details like no other home security company. Everyone has a smartphone. With SimpliSafe, you can use your smartphone to see what's going on in your place. You have a camera you can check out. So there's even a privacy shutter. So it's not even going to show what's going on. It's not going to be streaming information to whoever while you're gone. Once you want to check and see what's going on in your home, the shutter goes off. SimpliSafe shows you what's going on. And then when you are no longer interested, you want to go back to what you're doing with your day, that shutter comes back on. That's how a shutter works. You even hear the click so you know it's closed. So they've been testing this with all different metals and hinge designs for months and months. So it's not going to work for a week or 2 weeks or 5 weeks. It's going to work for the lifetime of your camera. This is why you have now, after all this, an effective home security camera with a thin, lightweight aluminum, that's the metal they settled on, privacy shutter that will work every single time. When you think about how much detail they put into that one aspect of this system, you can only imagine how much effort was put into every single part of the SimpliSafe security system. So if you want to check it out today, you can go to simplisafe.com/Barnwell. I'm going to spell all that because there are two words that might be hard to spell in that. SimpliSafe, SimpliSafe.com/Barnwell, BARNWELL. That one's my last name. It should be a little easier, but SimpliSafe, not really that hard to spell either, but just in case, SimpliSafe.com/Barnwell. Check out the SimpliSafe home security camera, and let's get back to the show. All right, so those are obviously what's happening with the projections. Let's talk about someone who you've written at length about already when it comes to this offseason, Odell Beckham, and your projection for him for the 2018 season. Now, of course, some people may have read this already on ESPN.com. As someone who has written about the Giants in the past, I know that their fans are very meek and have very mild opinions. If you say something about their players that aren't necessarily in line with what they might believe. But what were your thoughts on Odell Beckham? And what element of his 2018 projection might be surprising to Giants fans?
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't tell Giants fans where I have them picking in next year's draft before we start opining on the Giants. I get a lot of questions, as you would expect, about the how and the why for projections. And so I decided to pick out a specific instance of a projection that was suspicious or odd for people, including myself. Sometimes they surprise me as well. And I took some time. I sat down. I dug in and explained the process and where it comes from. And for that, it was Odell Beckham's touchdown total, which I have him. I have him at 8 right now. I initially had him at 7 when Brandon Marshall was on the roster. And again, it seems low. I mean, this is a guy that has had double digit touchdowns his first 3 years and had 3 and 4 games last year. So you'd expect him to be a double digit touchdown scorer. And again, I won't like it's again, this could be a long conversation. I have a lot of it in the article, but just I'll give you an example here. Since of why he comes up a little bit short and why it's not really a shot at his ability, but since 2007, Bill, there's only been 2 instances in which a player managed 4 double-digit receiving touchdown seasons over a 5-year period. Both were some fella by the name of Rob Gronkowski. So if Beckham does that this year, it will be Gronk, and Odell Beckham that achieve that feat. Touchdowns are just so hard to score. And they're about opportunity, really. I mean, that's what it comes down to. I've done a lot of research on this, and the skill is what gets you on the field. It's what gets you snaps and targets and pass routes. Opportunity near the goal line is what gets you touchdowns. And this is a guy who's under 6 foot. He's under 200 pounds. He has better teammates that demand work near the goal line, like Evan Ingram, for example. Now Saquon Barkley. Scheme is a factor. Coaching is a factor. I mentioned size. There's just a lot that goes into these things, and just looking at 3 years of touchdown totals, that's a small sample. You know, that's not enough. We need more variables than just past production in the touchdown category. So, again, that's kind of the in a nutshell what I'm kind of looking at here.
Yeah, I mean that makes total sense to me, and I think you sort of brought up the biggest reason why in my head, at least, is that look at the teammates he has that he did not have. In years past, 2014, when he came into the lineup, that was right after, I think it was actually the game where Victor Cruz got injured, or right afterwards, basically. So he didn't really overlap with any other, star receivers. 2015, the running game was terrible. 2016, the same thing. No real tight ends to speak of any note. Really, it was him and then Sterling Shepard in 2016 playing a secondary role, Victor Cruz playing a secondary role. And then, obviously, last year, who really knows, because Brandon Marshall was there for the 4 games, Beckham was there, and he still had 3 touchdowns, but no running game to speak of. And Evan Ingram's going to be a meaningful target in the red zone. And Saquon Barkley, of course, we know he's going to get a ton of touches, and he's going to be on the field in the red zone. The Giants are not drafting Saquon Barkley with the second-round pick, to have him be a 4 or 5 touchdown-per-season guy. He's going to get plenty of carries, so I think that's the tough part, it must seem like, in terms of just, it's not a reflection on Odell Beckham's talent, but just the reality of there's only so many guys who are going to score. The Giants aren't going to be the greatest show on turf Rams. So, I mean, it makes total sense to me.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, in the piece, I kind of compare him to Julio Jones, too, who's a guy that, as we know, has more size, but who has disappointed in the scoring department. And again, he's just another example on the other side of the coin. Why you have to look deeper than just touchdown totals. And, you look back at prior to last year, he was not a guy that scored many touchdowns, but he wasn't getting opportunity. The end zone targets weren't there. The goal line work wasn't there. And we always wonder, when will they finally get him the football near the goal line? And last year, of course, they changed offensive coordinators. They bring in Steve Sarkisian. He says he's going to get him the ball near the goal line. And guess what, Bill? He did. He made a really good effort to do that. He had 16 end zone targets, 7th most among receivers, but Jones still fell short of expectations in the touchdown department. Mm-hmm. That's fluky. Over time, you see regression in the mean in that sort of category. Guys will bounce back. So Jones is a guy who, I know this is crazy. I'm sorry if half your listeners shut the podcast off after this, but I would not be surprised at all if Jones scored more touchdowns than Beckham this season. It's just, that's what history shows. The trends are, if their usage is similar to what it's been, they're going to be very close.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Julio Jones is getting plenty of touches across the field. And then, like you said, he's getting touches in the red zone as well. So who knows if Steve Sarkisian will survive the 2018 season. I think a certain percentage of that fan base is stuck on him as the reason the Falcons offense declined last year. Is there a certain type of wide receiver who does excel in the red zone relative to his target total, or is it just really regression towards the mean for just about everyone?
I did a study on this a few years ago, and it was kind of a two-parter. One was that it's really just about opportunity. It doesn't necessarily matter who the player is. You get a target share by being good and seeing the field.
Right.
That's how you get the targets. But getting the work near the goal line is really what matters. And then there is a trend that suggests, and again, this is not a surprise, but we kind of know this. I just kind of quantified it. Height and weight. You know, if you're 6'5", 6'4", you're going to, over time, get opportunities near the goal line. It doesn't really mean you're more efficient in that area than someone who's 5'10", 5'11", but coordinators, they call plays for big players near the goal line. It's just that's what history has shown. Tight ends, big receivers like your Mike Evans or Kelvin Benjamin or Devin Funchess, those guys demand those targets down near the goal line. And, of course, the same kind of thing for weight. So that's a variable in the projections. You know, when I project out a touchdown rate, essentially, for a player, height and weight are absolutely key variables.
Makes total sense. And even if you think about someone like Brandon Marshall, who you brought up earlier, who early in his career was not, you know, got plenty of targets, but was not a red zone threat. Two touchdowns as a rookie, and 37 targets, but, you know, moving to the starting lineup in 2007, 7 touchdowns, 6 touchdowns, a 10 touchdown here in 2009, then 3 with the Dolphins, 6 with the Dolphins. So over a 5-year stretch, he averaged what? I think about 7 touchdowns. Yeah, he averaged 6 touchdowns a year, 7 touchdowns for 16 games. So you kind of figure, okay, that's what his baseline level is at. Next 4 years with Chicago and then that first year with the Jets, 11, 12, 8, 14. So, I mean, you know, if you're going to get the targets, eventually it's going to come around. It seems like it's just going to work for you eventually. So if you're thinking about Julio Jones in your fantasy draft this year, that 3 touchdown total from 2017, I should say, it does seem like a little bit of a fluke, even if he's not going to be, you know, necessarily a 15 touchdown guy. But he does have that possibility within his range of possibilities, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Marshall. I mean, over the past decade, nobody has more end zone targets. That guy has just been a force down near the goal line. So you're absolutely right. And yeah, I mean, Jones is probably going. Listen, if he converted a few more of those end zone targets last year, maybe he doesn't drop that wide open around midseason that he had that had frustrated everyone. You know, maybe we're talking about him as a clear cut or maybe even a contender with Antonio Brown to be the first receiver off the board in fantasy drafts this year. But instead, he's going in round two. So, you know, just kind of an example of how touchdowns can distort your view of a player in the NFL or in fantasy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so someone going, I believe, I would imagine at least, in the first round of fantasy drafts right now, not right now, but when we start having meaningful fantasy drafts or having regular fantasy drafts, someone who will be going in the first round is Kareem Hunt of the Kansas City Chiefs. And you have an interesting projection on him, do you not?
Yeah, I mean, I still like him, but I don't think I'm going to have him in many drafts this year. He just came in projection-wise a little low, and that's what happens. Every year you run projections, and then you can compare him to kind of your perception or your perceived opinion on players, whatever you want to call it. And some guys just jump out, for sure. And Hunt's one of those guys that came in a little low, and as much as I tried to jack up his volume because I like him, you know, I thought he was a great player going into the draft last year, and obviously the Chiefs agreed, and Andy Reid's happy with his investment. But the problem is Reid runs a pass-heavy, low-volume offense, and that at least over the past decade has limited the carries for his running backs. In fact, this is kind of crazy. The best his running backs have finished in terms of carries across the NFL is 20th over the past 11 years, an average of a 26th place finish. So they just don't get enough volume. And by the way, yards per carry, you know this, Bill, it's a really hard stat to predict. You have to be conservative. Yeah. It takes a long time before you get to a point where it's predictive. Kareem Hunt averaged 4.9 yards per carry last year. We cannot count on that. Even though he led the NFL in rushing last year, you can't count on that efficiency. You have to bring it down a little bit. I probably have him, I think, around 4.4 or so, which is above average, certainly one of the higher numbers. But you can't go too nuts on one season of a sample. Volume is what matters, and he's a step behind some of these other guys. And yes, Andy Reid wants to throw him the football more. He said that to us at the Combine. But at the same time, you know, that only goes so far. I don't expect him to be like your David Johnsons or Todd Gurley's or Le'Veon Bell's in terms of passing game volume.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you think about Kareem Hunt's season last year. He had so many long touchdowns early in the season that you knew weren't going to be something sustainable. Even if he was going to be a great player, and he was a very solid player, especially towards the final few games of the year, I mean, you can't get a 60-yard touchdown every week. It might seem that way, but it's too hard to do that. Just nobody in the NFL, no matter how talented they are, can do that on a week-after-week basis. And when you think about last year, the reason he got that opportunity in the Chiefs' offense was Spencer Ware got injured. Well, Spencer Ware is back this year. Charkhandrick West is in the rotation. And who knows what this offense is going to look like with Patrick Mahomes at quarterback, with Sammy Watkins making, I believe, $16 million a year now at wide receiver. Obviously, there's going to be more weapons for Patrick Mahomes. It might be a different sort of offense, and it might not be as dependent on the running game. So I think there's, a lot of question marks. And the things we do know, like you said, suggest that he's likely to have his volume decline and perhaps not have as many big plays. So it does seem like he's someone who, even if he is a useful player, might not be someone you want to take. It looks like his ADP right now is with the 9th overall pick in the draft.
Yeah, I view him as more, I feel more comfortable with him in round 2, but you're right, only 6 carries inside the 5 last year. That's not going to cut it. That number has to go up, and actually I specifically asked Reed about that at the combine, and he said he has no qualms using Hunt at the goal line in addition to Spencer Ware. He views them both as guys that can work at the goal line, so we'll keep an eye on Ware's health. That matters, of course, but I would expect Hunt to have a lower ceiling than you might think. And hey, I don't know, maybe he's just so good in year 2 that Reed just gets him the ball and force feeds it to him, but I don't think that's been the trend for Reed over time. I just think this volume or this offense is going to limit Hunt's volume just enough to that he's going to fall short of guys like Barkley and mm-hmm. Zeke and these guys who have such an easy path to massive touches.
Yeah, someone who mentions second-year players with Kareem Hunt, someone who had a meaningful role last year but didn't really get all that far because of some, I guess really a poor offensive line, maybe some other concerns, was Joe Mixon in Cincinnati. Averaged 3.5 yards per carry. And granted, we know that's going to be tough to sustain most guys, even if they're if you're reasonable level of talent, you're not going to be that bad on a year-after-year basis, but is someone who is as inefficient as Mixon was last year concern you when it comes to projecting his 2018?
Yeah, as you know, we're always trying to find stats that actually are predictive, right? You can learn something from. It's so hard. It's so hard in the NFL. But something I've learned in the past couple of years, and maybe we should change, we should give it naming rights, like the Jeremy Langford rule, something along those lines. Would be that if your efficiency is really on the polar end as a rookie, whether it's like yards per carry, yards after contact, forcing missed tackles, those sort of things. If you are on the polar end, whether it's good or bad, especially bad, you can actually learn something from that and project these players. So recent examples, Jeremy Langford and Matt Jones 2 years ago. Last year, the headliners were Paul Perkins and Devontae Booker. You know, so far, so good on that, and we'll keep an eye on it over time. But Joe Mixon is a guy that really jumps out for me. Yeah, you mentioned the 3.5 yards per carry. 1.7 after contact, not terrible, but certainly below average. But in terms of forcing missed tackles, not good. One of the worst in the NFL. So he's still very young. His receiving efficiency was outstanding. The O-line there was atrocious last year. You can make excuses here for sure. I've been watching him closely. I'm a little nervous about him. He's going to be expensive in fantasy this year, but I'm a little bit pessimistic. I'm a little worried about what I saw last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone else who's going to be rising up fantasy charts versus his role from last year is Jarek McKinnon, who seems like he is going to be the feature back for the 49ers, who everyone's excited about on offense this year, which will be Garoppolo hopefully playing a full 16-game season. They love him. They love his versatility. They love him as a running back and a receiver. Is he someone who excites you?
Yeah, and he's another guy just like Mixon. I put them right together. I view them very similarly. I know McKinnon's been around a little longer, and he's an A-plus athlete. That's fine. He goes to a situation here where Kyle Shanahan loves him, wants to make him a feature back. But again, a couple red flags here. Never more than 159 carries in a season. So we haven't seen him handle a role like this before. And his efficiency on lower workloads has not been good. Over the past 2 years, Bill, 3.59 yards per carry. That is worst in the NFL. 1.5 after contact, second worst. And that's on over 300 carries over the past 2 years. So again, you don't want to get too carried away with efficiency. Variables can change, and a guy plays better, that's fine. But when they're this severe, they should definitely stand out as red flags.
Mm-hmm. So Mixon was one of the rookie backs from last year's crop. Obviously, not the most productive, but someone who did play, you know, a useful role for some teams when it comes to fantasy football. Is there a back or backs in this draft class besides the obvious one, Saquon Barkley, who you think, you know, have a real opportunity when it comes to, you know, playing time kind of out of the box in a similar way, perhaps, to Kareem Hunt, even without perhaps any injuries?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of them. I think the that kind of 10 to, or actually maybe we should say like 14 to 20 or 22 range could be soaked up with rookies this year. There's so many guys from Rashad Penny and Darius Geis, Sony Michel, Royce Freeman, Ronald Jones. These guys have pretty clear paths to lead back jobs, and maybe Kerryon Johnson does the same. So I think Penny's my favorite from the group. He goes to Seattle. First round running backs in recent history have been workhorses and have been terrific. Mm-hmm. In terms of fantasy production. So I like him a lot. I think they've made changes to move from the league's pass-heaviest offense last year to a more run-heavy scheme this year, which is something that they did early in Russell Wilson's career. So I think that benefits Penny, who should be the lead back. And then as a sleeper, Bill, how about Jordan Wilkins? I love this guy from the Colts. I liked him going into the combine, kind of viewed as maybe this year's Chris Carson, if you will, that late round gem. And he goes in the fifth round and to a situation where he's basically competing with a bunch of scat backs, Robert Turbin, Marlon Mack, Nyheim Hines. Wilkins struggles a little bit after contact, but he's a potential three down back. He runs it well. He can catch the football. I'm really excited about him, and you got to love that landing spot.
Yeah, I mean, not like Marlon Mack did a lot last year to make you think he's going to be, you know, a three down back or a guy is going to get 250 carries this year. So certainly an opportunity to be had there. I'm intrigued by Ronald Jones. I think the Tampa offensive line is underrated. Adding Ryan Jensen this offseason going to help them out a fair amount. And the path is there. I mean, I Doug Martin's gone. Peyton Barber's an underrated back. I think Charles Sims to Chris Rogers also underrated, but pretty clear that Dirk Cutter does not want to commit to any of those guys. I think he could be someone who, really as early as week one, could be a very meaningful part of what might be a very underrated offense. They were ninth, I believe, I think they were ninth in pass offense DVOA, but you know, a team that was not as bad on offense last year as you might figure, having watched Jameis Winston for part of the year.
Oh, no doubt. Jameis Winston is very underrated right now. I think him missing time with injuries in Tampa Bay, falling short of perceived of expectations last year, really made him look worse than he was. He played good football last year. He took a step forward in a lot of key areas, and I think he's really a good kind of post-hype breakout sort of player this year. And honestly, I think the Bucs have made the leap on paper. I mean, that team is probably a top 15, certainly, or maybe a top 12 team. I think I have them ranked like 12. The problem is the NFC is just so loaded, so I don't know if the team's going to make a leap this year. The NFC is just so good, including their division. But you're right. The offense, I think, will be pretty good. They have a lot of weapons at wide receiver, two good tight ends. The O-line is better. And you're right. The only question with Jones is size, right? We were all kind of surprised he came in over 200 pounds at the combine. He comes in at 205. Can he hold up, or are we talking Jamaal Charles or Tevin Coleman sort of workloads in his career? Those are the red flags. But you're right. Opportunity is golden in Tampa.
I have to admit, Mike, I have been burned on that bandwagon more than once in my travels in the past. I have to be a little conservative with the Bucs, but I do see what you're saying. Logically, I agree with you. I have stuck my finger in that socket too many times. Let's finish up with the quarterbacks. Now, if anyone's gotten more than what Mitchell Trubisky's got this offseason, I would like to hear about it, because you think about where they were a year ago with the offensive weapons and the offensive coaching staff and how different things are now. You have Matt Nagy coming over from Kansas City, Mark Helfrich, former Oregon coach, as his offensive coordinator, Allen Robinson's here, Taylor Gabriel's been added, Anthony Miller, second-round pick, added to the receiving core, Trey Burden signed away from the Eagles. The running back situation was already very solid with Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen, one of the best weapons cores for any quarterback in all of football right now. And it seems like the Bears want to be this year's Rams in terms of improving, building, you know, infrastructure around their second-year quarterback and seeing him kind of take a big leap. Do you think it's likely with Mitchell Trubisky, and more likely than perhaps it would have been for Jared Goff a year ago?
Yeah, I'm definitely fired up to see what this offense can do. I mean, you're right. With the John Fox and Dowell Loggins offense last year was just super conservative, run heavy, mm-hmm. boring. They were trying to shorten games almost. It seemed like it was kind of something else. But his weapons are much better, as you just pointed out. The O-line's solid. They're in a situation where he has the tools to make a leap. The question is, does he have it? You know, is he good enough to get it done? We just don't know that yet. And mm-hmm. that goes for a lot of young quarterbacks right now, from guys who have been around a few years like Marcus Mariota, and we just mentioned Jameis Winston, not locks, of course, to be strong players, and Jimmy Garoppolo and Deshaun Watson. They were good last year. Trubisky mm-hmm. maybe wasn't as much, but that question is a big one. And it makes teams hard to project because you just don't know how good the quarterback is. He could be a bust. He could be terrific. You know, he was off target. He struggled with accuracy quite a bit last year. But again, how much do you want to focus on that when so much was going wrong around him, when he had such little mm-hmm. help, kind of like Jared Goff, as you mentioned, the year prior. So it definitely makes it a tricky team to project. But I'll tell you what, they're one of the most exciting teams to watch this year, to get excited for. The problem is, again, all these sleeper teams in the NFC, the Niners, the Bears, the Buccaneers, mm-hmm. how do they crack the playoffs? It's just such a loaded conference. I think there's going to be some sneaky good teams who end up 6-10 or 5-11 just because of how tough the schedule is going to be in the NFC this year.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, is that Bears schedule is awful difficult. They're getting the AFC East, I believe. They're getting the AFC East. They're getting the NFC West, so you're playing the Patriots. You're playing Bills with a very solid defense. You're playing the Seahawks. You're playing the Cardinals. You're playing, I guess Tampa is pretty easy, but you're playing the Niners, who might be much better on defense this year. And, of course, the NFC North. I mean, that's going to be a division that is perennially difficult. And you would presume you're going to get more Aaron Rodgers than you did in 2017. But Vikings might even be better than they were last year with mm-hmm. Kirk Cousins at quarterback. So it can be a thing where they do improve, but there are just concerns about the, you know, what their ceiling might be relative to preseason expectations. But Trubisky, I mean, like you said, the weapons are all there. I agree with you 100%. I'm a little concerned about the offensive line. And I think on paper, it's solid. You know, you have Charles Leno at left tackle, who's been improving. Cody Whitehair at center is very underrated. Kyle Long, you would hope, is going to be healthy. Bobby Massey is a veteran at right tackle. But, I mean, the tackles aren't necessarily great. Leno and Massey are their guys. They're fine. But I don't think either of them are, you know, on their best season Pro Bowl caliber players. And then the interior, they got rid of Josh Sitton. Bradley Sowell's left guard. That's going to be a downgrade. And then Kyle Long, I mean, it's tough to count on him to play all 16 games. I mean, the talent's certainly there. He's on the field. He's a valuable player on the interior. But we're now, I believe, we're 3 years from now. He made the Pro Bowl as a right tackle in 2015, but he was not really playing at that level. I think that was a very generous offer to him that year. His last year as a solid interior player was 2014. So certainly if he's there and he's healthy, he should be good, but it's tough to count on him. And if he's not playing at a high level, suddenly that offensive line looks like it might be a downgrade from what he had a year ago. So weapons are there, but I think the offensive line might struggle to be as effective as the Rams offensive line was in front of Jared Goff last year.
Yeah, definitely. The Rams O-line held up pretty well. I think it's more of a, like, I don't see superstars on the line. I just see a solid unit, mm-hmm. right? They bring in James Daniels, of course, in round two. He'll probably start at left guard, you know, Whitehair at center. So I think it's just one that's fine. You know, it's not a game changer. It's not going to move the needle like maybe Atlanta or the Eagles, obviously, arguably the best in the mm-hmm. league, the Steelers, some of these. Teams have difference-making offensive lines. I think Chicago is just solid and will get the job done. And with the skill guys they have around him, you know, a couple good tight ends. And you mentioned all of the skill guys they added, almost a total turnover, including mm-hmm. the 1A with Robinson. I think they're in great position to make a leap. But again, sometimes it's really hard to know if a guy has it or not. And he just has to play in good conditions to tell us. So we'll find out what Matt Nagy has and what Mitch Trubisky has here in 2018.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on. It's been to have you on for a while. But until the next time, where can people check out more of what you're working on?
Yeah, ESPN.com. We're doing some fantasy content over there, obviously. We have our rankings up. Did some NFL content as well. Wrote a little bit about the Browns recently at Mike Clay NFL on Twitter. So I'm around keeping busy. You know, there's no off season anymore, as you know, which is why we're doing this podcast on you know, in mid-May. So, but yeah, it's always fun, always exciting with the NFL.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thank you so much. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. All right. Welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. That's still my name. Still my show. I'm surprised they haven't fired me either, but we're going to start there. Talked about the NFL in the first segment of the show. Going to get to world football on the second half of the show. And of course, in the end, towards the end of the Premier League season, towards the end of the European club season, with the Champions League still to come, just finished the Europa League, World Cup still about a month away, and not really a lot of U.S. conversation to discuss when it comes to the World Cup, as I don't know if you've heard, we did not exactly qualify for the World Cup. The big topic of discussion right now in advance of the Champions League is the carousel of managerial jobs that are coming open, that might be coming open, becoming available. Lots of opportunities for managers who are unemployed to find new work. And joining me to discuss that is someone who, since the last time he was on this show, appears to have been hired to work for every single website at the moment. among his various duties, he's the managing editor of StatsBomb. He's the co-host of the Double Pivot podcast, Mike Goodman. Mike, how are you?
Good. It's good to be back, Bill. It's been a while, and I have been all over the various websites since I've been here.
You have been employed by pretty much every sports website I can think of. And not you know, it's not like you're getting fired. You managed to find, you managed to go to places at either the right time or the wrong time.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on whether you're focused on the clouds or the silver linings. But, you know, this is the time of every 4 years where it's great to be a soccer writer with World Cup coming up and tons of club stuff ending. So,
mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot of managerial opportunities to get to. Perhaps you are the Carlo Ancelotti of the soccer writing universe. But let's talk first about the jobs that are currently open. And I just want to get basically your thoughts quickly on whether the managers involved should have been sacked. So, simple one. Let's start with the easy one. The United States of America job.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's right that they're taking their good, sweet old time in terms of picking somebody. I think it's somewhat concerning that they, now that they you know, they've settled the presidential race and they have what is supposed to be system in place, there hasn't seemed to develop a structure of what they're really looking for. At this point, it doesn't make sense to hire anybody until after the World Cup, honestly,
right,
because there will be even more shakeout among international managers at that point. There's nothing between now and then that really needs to get done. But at that point, you would like to have some sort of an idea. Do they want to bring in somebody with sort of international acclaim to just put the best players? Do they want somebody who they think is going to be there for 4, 5, 6 years to build a program? Those are decisions they need to make now, so that a few months from now, they've got a list of candidates narrowed down and they're not just sort of casting around.
Right. So outside of the Premier League, two major club jobs likely to become actually already available, I believe, are Sevilla in Spain and then Borussia Dortmund, who have been through two managers already this season. I figure both those. Actually, no, Sevilla's been through two managers as well, no?
Yeah, they have.
All right.
Sevilla's a very weird situation, if only because they've had a really poor year, and part of that's not really their fault, but they are a team that should be on the fringes of Champions League qualification, and they finished in mid-table in the Liga while switching managers mid-season.
Right.
And you know, they're sort of in the unenviable position where their best, both players and managers, ultimately get poached by better teams, and they have to continue to rework their squad over and over again. And now, that used to not be a problem because they had a guy named Monkey who was the director of football, and he was a genius. Mm-hmm. He's now at Roma, and they have not really been able to institute a process since he's been gone that seems to fit with what they need. which is a little different than Dortmund, who was maybe in the same category of team. But they lost a great manager a year ago because they couldn't get along with Thomas Tuchel, didn't replace him well, and now it looks like they're leaning towards Lucien Favre, who is a good and accomplished manager, if somewhat boring.
And we don't want Dortmund to be boring for obvious reasons, but we'll get to them in a moment. What about the three Premier League jobs that already currently are open? Arsenal, Everton, and West Ham. Arsene Wenger, obviously, might shadow fired, might be the right way to put it. I don't know. Clearly, he's no longer there. Whether he was forced out or chose to leave is a topic of some discussion. Several of his assistants have left as well. Everton sacked Sam Allardyce after 6 months. It looks like possibly to hire Marcus Silva, formerly at Watford. And then West Ham and David Moyes did not come to terms on a extension. And do you think any of those three teams should have been more aggressive when it comes to holding on to the managers they already had?
Certainly it was time at Arsenal. It's probably been time at Arsenal for a couple of years. Arsene Wenger and Arsenal are very much, you know, everything ends badly, otherwise it wouldn't end. but it's time. Everton as well, you know, Allardyce was sort of a mid-season hire of last resort. Right. They were terrible early in the season, but they wanted just somebody to stabilize and make sure they didn't get sucked into a relegation battle. Allardyce did that, but his approach is sort of, he comes into a club and he explicitly says, my job is to keep you from getting relegated. Don't expect me to do any more. And then Everton fans did not particularly appreciate the suggestion that all they should be worried about was not getting relegated. It's not a relationship that was going to work long term, even if Allardyce is a perfectly fine manager. So I think that it was right to move on from him. Marco Silva is more interesting as a manager. He's somewhat more progressive. Generally speaking, runs out an aggressive defensive style, regardless of whether or not his players can handle it. So you're going to get somewhat more high scoring up and down matches under him, which is, I think, Everton as a team will love it, provided they have a baseline level of results, which I think they should. West Ham is a slightly trickier situation. Devin Moyes came in mid-season after Slaven Bilic was hired and did fine. Did absolutely fine. Kept them up. They were never particularly favored for relegation. They were sort of the fringes of the relegation battle. And he's got a track record as a very competent manager. But for him, what you end up running into is, like, modern-day sports, you really need to either sell results or hope. And David Moyes is kind of the king of grim realism, which does not work long-term as it might have 5 or 10 years ago, sort of from a PR perspective. And he has no interest in doing the kind of PR that builds investment from and goodwill from fans. So I understand why you move on from him, but I would be somewhat worried that West Ham are stuck in a somewhat difficult place in terms of being good enough to make their fans happy with managers who can actually keep them stable.
Yeah, and it also seems doubly complicated given that, you know, he can't bring back their old stadium as much as the fans might want. And it seems like, you know, the fans might be taking issue with how the club is being run beyond David Moyes.
Yeah, and I think they're right to take issue with how the club is being run, which, again, you know, they were sold the move to this new stadium was going to lead to them being better competitively. Yeah. And that just has not particularly been the case. Now, they've been largely fine, but you don't want largely fine if you're being told we're moving our class from our classic old stadium to this new, bigger, but somewhat anodyne, you know, environment. They were sold a trade-off that has not developed. And so, I think that they are right to, you know, fans are right to be somewhat frustrated by that. And there's nothing about the way the club has been run that suggests that that's coming anytime soon.
All right, so we covered the managers who have already lost their jobs and the jobs that are currently open. We have plenty more managers who may still be leaving their positions. But before we get to them, Just wanted to talk about our partners at SeatGeek. Of course, if you listen to the show, you know what SeatGeek does, but just as a reminder, just in case you are listening for the first time, just in case perhaps you are interested in buying tickets to a major upcoming event. Soccer season is pretty much over until the World Cup, but the NBA Conference Finals are on, NBA Finals to come, baseball's in full swing. Perhaps some of you are excited about your football teams after this offseason. Well, whether it's sports, whether it's concerts, anything that involves a ticket, you can make a purchase at SeatGeek. And what SeatGeek does is they see tickets from all over the web. They use their deal score technology, so you know you're getting a good deal. They rate every single ticket from 99 to zero. Now, I've never seen a ticket get a zero. I have to imagine it'd be pretty terrible. Don't buy that ticket with a zero. Buy the ticket with a 99. Buy the ticket with a 90. Doesn't matter. If you want to buy a mediocre deal, do that too, but it doesn't matter because whatever deal you want, SeatGeek is going to let you know the kind of offer you're getting. And on top of all of that, whether your ticket is $9,000, whether it's $10, whether it's $20, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase today by using my promo code, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. That's still my last name. It has not changed. But go to the SeatGeek app, make your purchase, enter in promo code Barnwell at checkout, and get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase today. Now let's get back to the managerial carousel. So those are the jobs that are currently open. We're going to fill those jobs in a minute, but we have to know who else is going to be available besides the managers who are currently free agents. And that involves a number of Premier League teams, by my count, as many as six Premier League teams who might have a credible case for moving on from their manager. And the most prominent one, of course, would be Chelsea, where Antonio Conte, it seems like, is likely to be fired or is likely to move on, but
yeah, it's been a wild ride the last couple of months with Conte. I think for most of the back half of the season, people assumed that he was going to leave, and there was a lot of talk linking him to the PSG job. But then PSG went and hired Thomas Tuchel, and so it's unclear where Conte would go if he left. But the performances down the stretch have not been good. They're not going to the Champions League next year. They finished in fifth. They have an FA Cup final coming up against Manchester United. But even should they win, on the whole, it's been a relatively disappointing season. So I would expect to see Conte gone, but I'm not sure he's going to be as comfortable being gone as he might have thought he was going to be 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Italian national team job also appears to be filled with Roberto Mancini. So that's another, you know, possible landing spot for him.
Conte had come from that job before Chelsea.
Right.
He's done a very good job. Italy overachieved the Euros and then missed the World Cup. So, look, Conte's a really good manager, and he knows what he's doing. But he seems like a guy who might find himself sort of losing the game of musical chairs this summer when everything stops.
Mm-hmm. Sort of in a similar way to Tuchel last year, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
Now, another prominent manager, former Champions League winner, Rafa Benitez, Newcastle with a £6 million release clause. Newcastle's going through the typical Newcastle hand-wringing after the season about how they don't want to lose their manager, but Mike Ashley also does not really appear desperate to spend money to fill Rafa Benitez's fantasies. So do you think Rafa Benitez should be aggressive about finding a new club, or do you think he's better off just sticking at Newcastle?
Look, I think it depends where he would end up. You know, I think he's linked to West Ham is, you know, reportedly interested in him, but like, it's not like, as we were just talking about, West Ham's management is particularly good either. Look,
right.
Benitez is incredibly popular at Newcastle. Benitez also has a history of always agitating for his owners to spend for him, and Mike Ashley has a history of being a terrible owner. So it's not a perfect match, but on the field, Benitez has done the thing that he does, which is incredible competent management in terms of building a solid defense and a team that knows how to counterattack and play to its strengths. I would sort of think that another year or two at Newcastle would make sense for him, but also Ashley would be incredibly happy to take the money and run if Benitez gets an offer.
Mm-hmm. Near and dear to my heart, of course, as a Leicester supporter, Claude Puel seems to have a habit of taking teams to mid-table and then inspiring them to fire him after a season in the case of Southampton, and now less than a season, perhaps, in the case of Leicester. Do you think he hasn't done enough to keep his job?
Yeah, I want to ask you that. I want to ask you what you think of Claude Puel after, what, three quarters of a season in charge of Leicester?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. It depends on what your baseline is. If your baseline is the team that won the title, then no, mid-table's bad. But if your baseline is literally any other point of this Leicester run in the Premier League, I think he's done a very solid job with a team that isn't really built all that well, who isn't constructed in a logical way, has been sort of overshadowed by the Riyad Mahrez saga for several transfer windows now, and still, are holding on for dear life and not trying to lose him, but haven't really made major strides to build a team without him in it when it comes to their talent on the wing. I think the defense is a mess right now. Wes Morgan really regressed over the second half of this season. Doesn't look to be the same guy he was, even last year during their run in the Champions League. So I think you have to give someone at least a transfer window, right? I mean, this is a team now where they've been in the Premier League for four seasons.
This is why I asked you. Because I see Claude Puel doing decent things on a regular basis with teams, and I see fan bases of teams and teams themselves walking away after one season not being happy with him. And I have trouble reconciling the two. He did an absolutely creditable job with Southampton in his one season there. Mm-hmm. He's done an absolutely creditable job with Leicester, and yet Leicester seems anxious to move on. Puel doesn't play a particularly exciting brand of soccer. His teams are quite good at preventing other teams from playing and doing that somewhat progressively, defensively pressing the ball across the field to make sure that other teams can't really build attacks. But they are conservative in attack. They make sure that they retain their defensive shape very well in order to do that pressing. So he is kind of boring, but he's also pretty effective at instilling what he wants to do in a mid-table side. So I don't know I don't know what Leicester are going to follow him with that would make it make sense for them to move on from Claude Puel.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that they've had now four managers in four Premier League seasons. Puel hasn't had a full year to work with, even a summer transfer window to work with. And I just don't know who they're going to get that's significantly better.
Look, it's possible that with the weird coaching carousel that we've got this summer, some somewhat bigger name falls through and you can offer them a decent salary. I mean, Premier League teams pay better than European teams. And then, all of a sudden you've got somebody like a Nagelsmann who jumps. And he's the manager at Hoffenheim who has been sort of picked for bigger things for years now but has been overlooked a couple of times. And if you can pull that off, that's worth taking that jump. But for the most part, if you're just going to sort of coaching carousel around, get somebody who's from another mid-table side, I don't understand why you're moving on from Puel in that case.
Yes. I would happily take Julian Nagelsmann. I don't think that is likely. It seems more plausible that it could be David Wagner from Huddersfield, the former U.S. international. But, he's done a fine job with Huddersfield, has a great, resume to work with in terms of being a young manager. But I don't see that as a clear upgrade on Puel.
So, Wagner is rumored as a Puel replacement. And it just doesn't make sense to me, because if the problem with Puel is that he's boring, well, Wagner doesn't fix that problem at all. He has this reputation because he started coaching as a member of Jurgen Klopp's staff, and Klopp has these sort of fun rock and roll exciting teams. But if you watch Wagner's Huddersfield play, they're very defensive. They're very good at being defensive, but they are a very conservative and defensive team. And so if the prime complaint and the prime reason to move on from Claude Puel is that he's not exciting enough, you're going to get exactly the same problem with his replacement if it's Wagner.
Right, yeah. And I don't know that Leicester are necessarily designed to be an exciting team.
But
let's move on. can talk about Leicester all day. That's not what this podcast is for. It's only for me personally, sadly. but Southampton, Watford, a couple other teams who could be in the market for a managerial change if they want to make an upgrade. And then on a much more important scale, it seems like both Madrid jobs could be in question with Zinedine Zidane, possibly pending what happens in the Champions League final, moving on to take over the France national team. And Diego Simeone, who just won the Europa League with Atletico, it seems to perennially be in the discussion to move to a bigger club. Do you think either of the Madrid jobs come open this offseason?
I suspect Simeone's not going anywhere. Everybody always seems to like to toss his hat in the ring for jobs. The only real place I could see him potentially moving is Inter. Again, he played there. He's got a close association with it. It does not seem to me like he is particularly close to leaving Atletico for just another job. Real Madrid is a little more interesting because Zidane's been there a long time for a Madrid manager. They usually go through managers every year and a half, 2 years tops. If he were to win the Champions League again, this year for the third time in a row, I don't know why you wouldn't want to walk out on top from that situation. And then things do get interesting because Madrid is going to splash cash on anybody who's a big name, including guys like Mauricio Pochettino, who are well ensconced who's well ensconced at Spurs and sort of building his own little cult there. So I think that could put all sorts of things in play. If that were to happen, and I don't think it's particularly unlikely, but it's as much as anybody ever calls their own shots at Madrid, it appears Zidane is calling his own shots at Madrid because nobody else would have survived the first half of the season that Madrid had under him.
Okay. So one more candidate I have to ask you about, and then we're going to go through and actually pick managers for all these teams. Do you think Massimiliano Allegri is going to stay at Juventus for another year?
I think I do, if only because it's...
You don't sound confident.
We'll get to this as we actually pick names, that the jobs that would tempt him away are all leaning towards not hiring him. So unlike Conte, who seems like he's going to go and might end up on the outside looking in, I think Allegri gets to stay instead of being on the outside and looking in.
Interesting. I agree with you. So then that leaves... I guess Leipzig is open. We can talk about them a little bit, but let's start then. Let's start with these jobs, and let's go top bottom in terms of most important to relative, at least important. And Madrid are favored, I believe, to win in a couple of weeks in Kiev in the Champions League final. Let's say they win. Let's say Zinedine Zidane moves on. We'll start there. Who do you think becomes the Real Madrid manager in 2018?
Oh, boy. I think they make a push for Pochettino, and I think it ultimately does not happen.
Okay.
And so that means that leaves us with sort of all of the handful of famous names we're used to. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say something incredibly wacky that I don't think anybody's really talked about.
Brendan Rodgers.
I'm going to say Arsene Wenger.
I like that a lot for some reason.
He has been incredibly loud about not wanting to retire, and Real Madrid are going to want a name. And most of the names out there have either already managed at Madrid or probably aren't big enough. The other option, I think, would probably be Antonio Conte at that point as well.
Would Unai Emery be an option?
I don't think... Talent-wise, absolutely. He's a good manager. But I don't think you get to fail at PSG and then go to Madrid, even if you have some roots in Spain. That seems to me... The last time they tried to do that was hiring Rafa Benitez after he had been... he had run his course at Napoli, and Benitez lasted 6 months before, getting fired there. And honestly, Benitez was well more accomplished than Emery. I would say that if you look at Emery and you look at his one jump has been mostly a failure at PSG, he gets to get a lower job first to get rehabilitated.
Makes sense. So you're going to say Wenger. I'm going to say Conte. I think that's the most logical landing spot for Conte, given the jobs are likely to come open. And are we saying basically Lucien Favre is going to move from Nice to Borussia Dortmund?
Yeah, that it's not done yet, but I think that is exceedingly likely.
Okay, so what about Arsenal then? Who fills Arsene Wenger's shoes at Arsenal?
Everybody seems to be leaning towards Mikel Arteta, and I get it. It makes sense.
Do you get it? It doesn't make sense to me. Please explain it to me. Please explain how this makes sense to me.
Well, here's what I'd say. If this was basketball, it would make an entire amount of sense, right?
Okay.
You look at the good player at the team, then Pep Guardiola's number one assistant coach. This is like, one of Pop's lieutenants getting a head coaching job. The thing is, is that that's not usually how soccer works, right?
Right.
Usually the assistants go and get a lower level managing job first before they come up. But I don't think it's crazy to skip that step and say, Arteta's got great both playing pedigree and now coaching pedigree in terms of getting to coach next to Guardiola. If he impresses during the interview process, I understand it. Now, for me, I might prefer, you don't ever want to be the guy after the guy, right? And
right.
So I might prefer, if I was running Arsenal, to bring in somebody like an Ancelotti for a season, mm-hmm. 18 months, two seasons, and then hire somebody like Arteta, who you hope can be there for 10 years. But mm-hmm. I understand the thought process as to why you might think that Arteta has the makings of a very good manager.
It's possible. It just seems like it's taking a major risk just because.
Yeah, it is.
I
would say that top clubs don't take risks often enough. That very rarely do top clubs take risks on managers, and they should perhaps be more willing to do it.
Mm-hmm. So if you were a member of the Kroenke family who had the ability to make this decision, you would choose Carlo Ancelotti?
Yeah, I think that's what I would do. But I think that they're going to choose Arteta.
Mm-hmm. It seems like that's the most plausible candidate, too. Would you want to go for someone like a Julian Nagelsmann, who kind of, is in between those two grounds, or someone who isn't very experienced, and someone who has had more success as a manager during his young career?
I don't understand why Bayern Munich didn't hire him, honestly. I would be a little concerned as Arsenal that you are bringing in a very young manager, albeit one that's been quite successful, to change leagues to a place where he does not have any experience managing. I think that is hard even for very good managers. I mean, I think you saw somebody like Jurgen Klopp, who did it and did it successfully, really did have ups and downs and a challenge in the first year or so. Sort of balancing all of the pressures that being a Premier League manager can bring. And so you'd have to, Nagelsmann, I think a lot of people think is very special, but mm-hmm. I would be slightly concerned bringing him in somewhere at the level of Arsenal, with the hopes that he would succeed for a long period of time. First, it's not unreasonable, but there is risk involved.
Okay. So if Arsenal hire Arteta, then Chelsea, I guess, would be the next biggest job. Who would Chelsea hire?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And they are also somebody who seem to be linked to Pochettino in ways that are weird. There have been a lot of there have been both Allegri and some other managers have sort of mentioned that they might be interested in the Spurs job, despite the fact that Pochettino is seemingly entrenched at Spurs. And so it's led people to wonder exactly what's going on. And so I wonder if that would be Chelsea's first choice. I think that for them it would make sense if they could get him. I mean, Pochettino is quite good. Do I think that they are going to? I don't know. Would they? Should they? Yes. So that's what I'll say.
So who will they? Do you think?
I can't, my podcast co-host, Michael Kelly, will end me if I pick Pochettino as the thing, because he is a Spurs fan.
That's the problem.
So,
yeah.
So despite the fact that I really want to, like really, really think that this is a realistic possibility? I'm hesitant to say so. And then, I'm going to cast around elsewhere. And despite having said that, I don't think Emery would end up at Madrid. I think he is the kind of manager that can end up at Chelsea if their managerial search fails, basically, where they're sort of left having tried to get Pochettino and it didn't work. And now, Tuchel's already at PSG, who is another name. Luis Enrique is out there, but he's apparently asking for a lot of money. And so I think the question to me is it comes down between, you know, the ex-Barcelona manager Enrique and somebody like an Emery. And Chelsea are weird. They haven't seemed like they want to spend top dollar in recent years. So I'm going to say that they take a swing at Emery.
The same club who once paid, I believe, a £16 million release clause for Andre Villas-Boas. Now too cheap to pay for Luis Enrique. Things have changed in the Premier League. What about Leonardo Jardim? Do you think he would be possibly in the running for Chelsea?
I think he's done a really good job at Monaco, and he is also in the sort of he has a relationship with Jorge Mendes, who has a relationship with Chelsea. So that he's the super agent Jorge Mendes. So I think that is also a path that they could walk and is a reasonable option for sure, but it's also risky. I mean, he's not necessarily more accomplished than some, it's less accomplished than Unai Emery is. But yeah, I could see that happening.
Okay. Lightning round then for the rest of these Premier League jobs. I'll go Leicester. Who do you think Leicester should, or perhaps will hire?
Wagner.
You think so? Then who does Huddersfield get in return?
That's a more interesting question. I don't have a good grasp on that. I would not be surprised to see them reach down into the championship and pick somebody we don't expect.
Would they possibly be a landing spot for someone like Sam Allardyce?
I don't think so. I think that they have generally tried to institute a more progressive approach. And so I think that they would probably be looking for somebody who is younger and less and more proactively focused on improving the team as opposed to reactively focused on surviving. Not that that's necessarily the right decision, incidentally, but that would be what I would
expect. Look at Swansea being the negative.
Southampton keep Mark Hughes, even though I don't think they should.
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to say, where they turned to Mark Hughes after that strategy seemed to work out poorly. And I guess he kept them afloat technically, but causation might not be so clear there. If Rafa Benitez leaves, who does Newcastle go after to replace him?
Well, that's a good question. Now, that's somewhere where, honestly, I think an Allardyce type is likely.
Not Allardyce.
I can't imagine they'd go rehire Alan Pardew, who was there for years. But, I mean, if you're looking at a club where it's going to be like the local British manager carousel, it's going to be somebody like that at Newcastle.
I think it would be very funny to see them hire Arsene Wenger, to be honest with you.
It would be.
It would be very exciting. And then let's finish up with the important job, or perhaps the most important job for our listeners. Who do you think should be hired from this group of managers to run the United States national team? And then who do you think this time next year will actually be in charge of the U.S. national team?
Oh, boy. I don't think, out of everybody we've talked about, David Wagner is the guy who gets linked because he's American. He's also the only guy out of this group that I would consider hiring. I think he's a reasonable choice if he wants the job. I'm not sure he would want the job, but I think for the most part, if it's not him, this sort of family of big name European managers isn't the right tack to take. And the U.S. should really be looking towards somebody internally who will be there for 4, 5, 6 years and will sort of grow the program. Who that is, I don't know. I think Vermees was linked for a while. He just re-upped for a big deal. So he's probably not going to leave. And so I think that there are real and open questions that I don't have a good answer to. But the quick answer is, if it's not Wagner, I hope it's nobody we've talked about yet.
My dream forever, even long after he's dead, will be Marcelo Bielsa. I don't think it's actually going to happen, but I'm allowed to dream. That's not against the rules.
That's true. Why not? And as long as players are made out of bionic legs, Bielsa will be great.
Well, if there's anything the U.S. has, it's a group of players who never seem to get injured at key moments. That didn't cost us in this last qualifying cycle. So we may have to devote the next 10 minutes, Mike, to you plugging all the various places you write and record content on the internet. But where are some places people can check out the work you do?
Okay. I'm the managing editor over at StatsBomb, which is a soccer data company. We've just lost data collection services, so you should definitely check us out. Co-host of the Double Pivot podcast, which is a twice-a-week podcast, once-a-week free podcast, where we do all sorts of nerdy soccer content. And then you can catch my writing at the Action Network and the Athletic and 538 and the Ringer and more or less any other website you care to go to.
Any place that has soccer content, you will probably find Mike Goodman doing good work. Mike, as always, pleasure to have you on. Hopefully, when the U.S. hires Antonio Conte, we can have a celebratory podcast about it.
All right, Bill. It's good to talk to you.
All right. Thanks so much to the Mikes for hopping on the show today. Mike Clay, ESPN, Mike Goodman of a lot of websites. StatsBomb, you heard me, says a lot of them. Just go anywhere that people write about sports and he's there. But more Bill Barnwell show coming next week. I believe we're going to have in the weeks to come. Mina Kimes is going to be joining us again, taking time out of her busy schedule to record some off-season grades. A lot of football stuff to come during this off-season. So thanks so much for listening, and more audio on the way.